Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford.
Hello, I'm Charlotte Metcalf, and my guest today is the jeweller Theo Fennell. Once associated with being the supplier of big colourful crosses and skulls and glitzy bling to celebrities, a breakthrough exhibition of his work at the Museum of Mankind in 2007 made people look at the skills involved in jewellery making very differently and cemented his reputation as one of Britain's most talented, original and inventive craftsmen. Aside from his jewellery, we're also here today to talk about his new book. It's called The Glory Years, Further Chapter of Accidents, and it's the sequel to his first book, I Fear For This Boy. It's a series of autobiographical sketches, and I don't think I can remember a book that has ever made me laugh quite so much. I'm delighted to introduce our listeners to one of the funniest men I know, Theo Fennell. A very warm welcome to Radio Oldie.
Good morning.
Let's start with the book, because apart from being hilarious, it's received extremely high praise from the novelist William Boyd. I know he's your friend, but he's described your stories as beautifully shaped and almost Jacobean. And having talked to him about his view on Chekhov on Radio Oldie, I know there is no writer he holds in higher esteem. Fear for This Boy had widespread rave reviews, and I expect more will follow for this new one. So can you start by telling us why you started to write these books?
I wrote these in lockdown, really because my father used to tell me these stories that made me howl with laughter in a way that summoned up those pre-war years in which he was a young man, so elegantly and in such a funny and self-deprecating way that I always wished he'd written them down so I could have given them to my daughters and, I suppose, grandchildren and things, but he died quite young. So in lockdown, I thought I would write down some, I suppose, you know, short stories, you know, little passages from my life that I'd found funny at the time, or funny in retrospect in some cases, and had them bound for a Christmas present for my daughters and friends and family, just as a sort of bit of fun. So when I'd done, I suppose, you know, 100 or odd pages worth, I gave it to my wife, Louise, to have a look at. And she put lines through Greek traps saying, boring, nobody cares, stop being such a snob, or whatever it was, and these terrible things. I looked at her and I thought, good Lord. Anyway, she was the toughest editor you could imagine. So they'd come back, shriveled to three or four pages from sort of things as long as War and Peace. And I gradually realised she was right. And I finished it. I sent it to Will Boyd. Anyway, Will went through it and showed it to a publisher, a friend of his. And we met up in the Chelsea Arts Club. And literally, he said, I'd like to publish it. And the final thing was looking for a title. And as we were getting to the last throes of lockdown, Louise found this old bag, this old canvas bag, underneath a pile of old clothes. Very heavy. And she opened it, and inside were all my sisters, my two sisters, and my school reports. The weird thing is that I'd rather thought I was a better pupil than I was, not just considerably brighter than I obviously was, but also a little bit more nicer. And it ended with this final report from my tutor on this bit of paper that was meant to be three pages worth of 5 years of his thoughts about one's pros and cons, what one might be good at, you know, where perhaps one had a weakness here, one had a strength there, whatever. None of it at all. It was just this one sentence written across, which said, I fear for this boy. And it was almost like a sort of tombstone, you know, in its way. And Louise said, oh, crikey, that's a bit... I mean, she did laugh, I have to say. She laughed rather too much, I think. But anyway, she did laugh. And said, that's got to be the title of the book. Which, of course, was a great title.
It's a brilliant title. Also, I think what's so fantastic about this book, it sort of plugs into a very joyous universal truth, in that so many great people, including, of course, Winston Churchill, you know, were dreadful at school. And the fact that you have completely turned your life around despite having endless, very, very funny mishaps along the way that we'll get on to in a minute. And here we are sitting today in your beautiful, beautiful shop in Garrison Square in Chelsea Barracks.
I think the thing in those days, when I really, you know, I was so interested in people's reactions to things and what would happen if, and I think it was just the same delight as a you know, a child going, what would happen if I lit this blue touch paper? Or what would happen if I, you know, if I do put my hand through the window?
One of the funniest chapters was when you saw a very, very, very beautiful girl walking towards you in a park with her, what you assume was her grandmother, and you decided to show off.
I did.
So, just to get her attention. So you kicked the ball back and it smashed her grandmother in the face.
I mean, in retrospect, I'm going, you know, what was I even thinking of? But it was... and do you know, when I walked past that, you know, garden of St Luke's, which is now a sort of proper, you know, hard football pitch and whatever, I still get this awful kind of cold feeling up my spine of this poor old lady sinking like a stone to her knees. And then, but yeah, it was, I think that sort of thing, that was showing off. And of course, showing off is... one of the other reasons for...
The kick went wrong, is that right? It just, you missed...
Yes, I mean, I kicked it in the middle. It came off the side of my foot and it went straight into her face. She went down poleaxed. The girl looked at me as if I was hellish. I sort of smiled to her and said, I'm a wolf. Anyway, we had to take this old woman's teeth out and wrap them in a handkerchief. And a doctor, because he saved the road, this hospital happened to be in the thing, came up and sort of told me to go and get her... Whatever it is. I said, what about my handkerchief? Anyway, it went very badly wrong. I said, could I ring you? Can I have your telephone? In fact, I'd only actually asked for a telephone number after I'd sort of almost killed her grandmother and she'd been shrieking at me to get my handkerchief back, but also to ask if she was all right. It didn't come out that way. So, you know, my motives weren't entirely dishonourable. But, you know, showing off is a very dangerous thing, especially in things you can't do very well, you know, whether it's...
Skiing, let's talk about skiing.
Skiing, yes. I think the thing with skiing was that I did it when I was very young and then hurt myself quite badly. But in those days, it was, you know, if there were 20 people on the slopes, you were lucky. And you were still doing a thing called the Stem Christiana, which was, you know, Stem Christie's, it became. It's a sort of herringbony thing. Or a telemark, which is my parents did, which is one pole, you sort of punted yourself around because you didn't get down very steep slopes. You just slid down and then sort of went along the road. So it was sort of a mixture of land life thing for people to know about those things. And it never really appealed to me. It was always cold and nasty and leather boots in those days and whatever. When I went back again, I went with people who sort of knew how to ski, and it was sort of small skis. And it was easier, but it was so crowded. And so full of people sort of smashing into each other and sort of waiting in queues, and everybody queue barged, and I fell off almost every type of thing. And I just found the whole thing exhausting, and I didn't get enough sort of fun out of, you know, sliding down. But then what would happen is, because everybody I knew who skied was so much better than I was, they wouldn't leave me with the sort of beginners to sort of ask about, you know, whatever it is. I'd be sort of taken to the top of mountains and held off by these people showing off. And of course, there's a moment at which you think, I can't let myself down. Well, I didn't want to do that skiing, so I would sort of try and, you know, follow the leaders and things. But of course, you just get worse and worse and tired and things, and then angry, and then make an ass of yourself. And Louise and I gave up on the same day. We just said, we've had enough of this. We're going to never go skiing again. And to be honest, I have to say, I would rather be in the sun somewhere than I would be halfway up a mountain surrounded by angry people in absurd outfits.
I do agree with you, but maybe we're in a minority. Yeah, cheer me up no end. Mm. But it's incredibly funny. But let's go back to your beginnings for a minute. You were born in Egypt. Your father was a soldier.
Yeah.
And you moved around a lot?
We did. So we left there when, I suppose, I was two or three, and then... I can't remember anything really until Pakistan in the mid-50s, where he was at Staff College, and then Germany, Malaya, whatever. So I remember those bits, but I was sent back to school in England.
The prep school at eight?
No, the prep school when I was sort of five and a half.
Oh, gosh, little pre-prep.
Because, well, at the time I thought they were in India or something. It never occurred to me. And there were quite a lot of other boys who were sort of in not much older than I was, whose parents were in the diplomatic or oil business or something. But in fact, they weren't in India at all. They were in Lichfield, which was about 50 miles away from just, I think they just thought, you know, he's an absolute pain in the arse. Sort of. So I was there, funny enough, for a year.
Were your sisters dumped as well?
Well, they're a lot older, 18, so I mean, they were 8 years older, rather. So they were 13, they were already at boarding school. I can't remember quite what happened. I got some sort of, you know, something wrong with the earache or something. They suddenly appeared in the hospital. I hadn't seen them for a year. My sisters with a Davy Crockett hat to give me. And my mother with, you know, some extraordinary book that was unreadable. You know, probably meant for a 30-year-old. And they said hello. And I didn't find out they'd actually been in Lichfield until I was about 25. When my sister said, no, we were in Lichfield. I said, didn't you enjoy India? We'd never been to India. I said, I thought you were all right in India. And they said, no, we were in Lichfield. It didn't sound as exotic, really. So I was there, and then in the holidays, I would go back to Malaya, wherever it was, especially in the summer when it was long enough. Sometimes I'd stay in England with various great aunts, various very curious great aunts, for shorter stays with other boys who were at school with their parents. So, and a very multifarious lot they were, very protean. So I got to stay with people of all backgrounds and everything, and see the workings of their houses, as it were, which is interesting. You know, the family unit, which is something you very rarely see. You don't see a sort of a family of Muslims or a family of French people, or whatever it is, from within the house. So I found that very, and I sort of constantly looking for, I suppose, for a sort of surrogate family. And I was looked after by them, all my sort of great aunts who were, all of them, what would now be certifiable, I think, in the way they behaved, who'd either lost their husbands in the Great War, or had become spinsters because of lack of men, you know, in the early 20s.
Between the wars.
So they were an extraordinary lot, and lived a life so removed from anything you can even imagine, because they were Edwardians down to their, you know, the last low hem of their skirts. My great aunt Mary, in fact, who was a very big influence in my life, I watched the moon landing with in 1969, and she was born in 1880, so she was 21 when Queen Victoria died. And when she said, "What are we all watching?" You know, because we're all sort of huddled around the television. And I said, "We watch some people land on the moon." She said, "It's ridiculous." I said, "No, they are." And she went to the curtains, and she just pulled them back a bit to have a wee peek to see if she could see anybody landing on the moon. And she said, "Well, that's ridiculous." As you walked past to walk out of the room, she said, "Who are they?" And my father said, "Well, they're American." She said, "Well, of course they are, just showing off." And walked out. The wonder of spending time with them then was that I was sort of privy to a world of musical songs and Edwardian, the Edwardian world, and how their world had been, you know, before the Great War.
Where did they live?
They lived outside what is now Watford.
Gosh.
And they'd all had sort of their own places, but one by one, they just gathered in this house.
So then what, how many in the house?
Well, there were four aunts and a cousin and a daughter, Bobby, who was the same age as my mother, but not as other women. She was not sort of all there, as it were. She had her teeth removed because she bit people if they went anywhere near her. And she had a full-time nurse. And she had the disturbing habit of like that. That was a conversation. Then suddenly, having done that for a bit, and sort of, you know, doing that strange thing that the people in her teeth do, sort of sucking in and things. She suddenly said, "What a beautiful day we've had today. It's been absolutely..." Even more disturbing than the noise she made. But she would occasionally escape the house and run around the garden and the sort of, you know, they had a maze at the end of it. I mean, a tiny little maze at the end of it. Shedding her clothes as she went. So she was quite naked. And the man that cut the grass and things would sort of find her and bring her back, always looking the other way. And upstairs only had gas lighting. So even when they were on, it was quite frightening for...
Yeah, lots of shadows.
Lots of wood and things. And so it was, I always rather dreaded going there. Every lunch, from the age of 8 onwards, but we sit down to lunch, which would be a sort of lettuce and an egg. I mean, it wasn't as if it was sort of in any way anything else. But my opened with a glass next to it would be a bottle of Eindkoop Pale India Ale. Because they had no experience really of male people, they just assumed that men had beer for lunch, which may well have started me in the rocky road. But
and by the time you left Eton, you went to York to study art, is that right?
Well, my parents were then living in Yorkshire, and just happened to be one of those places that was just fantastic.
Did you know you were talented at art before you went? I mean, what made you choose art school?
Mixture of things, I think, of which the presiding thing was laziness, I think, was the indolence was the governing factor. I think I realised I wanted to do something creative. I wasn't quite sure what. And, of course, things had changed so mightily in the 60s, you know, from 1964 when I first went to secondary school to 1969 when I left. Whole world changed. And whereas at the beginning of, England especially changed, beginning of the 60s, when I went to walk around London when I was sort of 12 or 13, every 12 or 13-year-old that wasn't, you know, sort of a butcher's boy or something, I mean, you know, in a work clothes, was in a suit and tie of some sort, or, a jersey and shorts and a jacket, everybody dressed like their parents. So that was enormous. I mean, it's almost impossible to explain what that revolution was. And it came with television, and it came with music, and it came with everything, with comics and things. And suddenly, there was this explosion of stuff. You know, and you look at, Ready, Steady, Go, or, Top of the Pops, where it was, and people would be wearing these young clothes that old people didn't wear. So everything changed. I turned up to my first day at York Art School in a tweed suit. I think probably no one of my father's was a big, shiny brown brogues, to find every single person there in jeans and a T-shirt, obviously. I mean, if I'd even... So from the word go, it was a slightly sort of strange atmosphere.
But you got into buying Shaw from there, which is really, really fantastic.
Well, York was fantastic.
Yeah.
When I came down to London to go to the Byam Shaw, I realised that I'd had this fantastic grounding in all sorts of things that I would say the best year's education I ever had that served me best through the last 50-odd years was that year at York, because I did a bit of pottery, I did a bit of sign painting, I did perspective drawing, whatever, and all those things have been of real use to me. But when I got down to London, just up the road was the RCA, the Royal College, people at Central, people at whatever, you're suddenly seeing at the end of this unbelievable blooming, because it was only a few years after, people like Peter Blake and Hockney and Patrick Proctor and all those sort of people had come out, Alan Jones, had come out of the RCA, and there was this blooming of talent in London. And you sort of suddenly realise that, your efforts were kind of, not as good as these people. And I don't think I had enough self-confidence then to believe I could have got better. It didn't occur to me that practice makes perfect. And I realised that, you know, this level of dedication to one end was an extraordinary thing that I didn't have. I found myself being, you know, led down so many different paths, whether it was poetry or, you know, songwriting or guitar, all of which I did appallingly badly, but nonetheless, all of which I embraced and diluted the whole thing.
So what took you to Hatton Garden?
People started to talk about me as, you know, what are we going to do with theatre? And Great Aunt Mary, the so often the saviour of my life, found an advertisement that said, old established firm, something like this anyway, old established firm of silversmiths looking for a young man of good education and gentle background, of artistic leanings and good looks, to learn the trade with old men, learn the trade with older men in established, whatever. Anyway, nowadays, of course, you'd run a mile. You'd think they'd bring up Operation U-Trip or something. but in those less fluent days, I went along and I got offered the job.
This is Edward Barnard.
Edward Barnard, yep, yeah. Yep.
And how long were you there for?
A few years. It was actually a sort of Damascene moment for me. Well, not straight away, because for a few months I just did this and that. Because I suddenly realised that just how broad the kind of work of silversmiths was. Because we get all the cuts that they'd made in the old days for the big retailers to repair or engrave or whatever. So the FA Cup and the Wimbledon Cups and all those sort of things. So in they'd come with all these great names on them. All sorts of stuff. Not just great beauty and great skill and craftsmanship, but of a sort of emotional heft that I hadn't believed that inanimate things could really have. And then one day this gold champagne flute came in, and in somebody's writing, you know, a facsimile, had been engraved, "Good morning, Diana." And I said, what a cool present, you know, good morning. So somebody must have come in, some sort of lady's maid must have come in with a, you know, bottle of champagne, this gold thing, present for this young swain. And I just thought, you know, there's more to this than I thought. And then after, I suppose, a couple of months, I hadn't been allowed out of the office bit, which was incredibly Dickensian. I was sent down to the workshop, into what really was Santa's workshop, with all these people making extraordinary things. And I really did fall in love with it. I loved what you could make. I loved the processes, the characters. And the characters in those days were fantastic. I mean, I used to laugh myself sick every day talking to some of these ridiculous old boys who, you know, their views on life and other people. And eventually, I realised I wouldn't get anywhere in Barnard, as much as I loved it, much as a wonderful place to work it was, because it was one of those old-fashioned companies where they refused to do work for various people because it was too modern or it was too... or they were foreign. They came from abroad or something. So I took a little studio opposite, in which was a man called Fritz. He was the most fantastic craftsman. And, he taught me how to do all sorts of stuff. And I realised that I didn't have the patience to be a jeweller, but that I would have to learn all those things to be able to design them. So that's how that happened. And then...
And when did you open your shop then?
Opened the first... the first shop, the only shop, in those days, a few years later, because I was spending every night going to see people with half-finished designs. And, I mean, I had no idea what I was doing at all. So I literally knew nothing about business at all, and I had nobody to ask. There was no internet, there was no anything. I mean, you could go to a library and try and find a book about how to run a business, but I had no one, either family or friend or anyone I knew who had a business or ran a business, did anything. So it was a bit of a sort of hit and miss, and not a miss, not much hit, to be honest. So I found, just walking past to go to the tube station one morning on the corner of Sydney Street and Fulham Road, what had been the old Victoria wine shop. And a friend of mine had just qualified as an accountant. So I said, do you want to come and do the accounts? And he said, why not? And another friend of mine had been running a shop and had just sort of broken up with his business partner who he worked with in the shop. And so I said, well, you know how to run a shop. So the three of us.
So 1982, roughly, was it?
Yeah. Probably the three most inept business people in London formed this this three-way partnership and sort of bumbled forward.
What was your first big... I mean, what broke through?
Essentially, what we would do is go to every party, every club, every opening, and just hand out cards. So we started to get a bit of traction, as they say. And then we got some investment, which came with a bit of kind of, a little bit of business knowledge, a little bit of business planning. But it also meant that I signed away my name, you know, without even knowing what I was doing, to be honest, for a very small percentage, which obviously haunted me for, you know, 20-odd years, more. I think I had a very rosy attitude as to, you know, people who were, you know, businessmen would obviously be straightforward and straight and honest and think whatever it is, because, you know, that's what they were. And they were, you know, they had some letters after their name, all that sort of stuff. And I think that was really the first time that I found myself realising that, you know, the professional middle classes, as it were perhaps quite as straightforward and honest as I thought they'd be, you know, at every level.
Yeah.
I think that... I don't think I learnt the lesson quickly enough. Without a doubt, my own naivety and my own sort of bullheadedness exacerbated it by umpteen degrees. But and I think I was too lazy to do things like, you know, due diligence, and I should have done whatever. So what I do say to, you know, the young now is, you know, you've got to get a good lawyer, you've got to read the small print, you've got to make sure you get paid up front, you've got, you know, all those things. So it was really when a couple of sort of famous people started buying things off me. I think more importantly,
Harrods. Elton John in huge numbers.
Well, Elton and you know, some other people, Queen and those sort of, but people knew about it, they told other people.
Yeah.
The great thing was that our point of difference, without really knowing it, was that we were designing from scratch. Everything in the shop that we had, little shop we had, we had made and we had designed, which was almost unheard of in London then. Because we couldn't afford diamonds and, you know, rubies or whatever, we were using bright, semi-precious
stones.
Wonderful,
brightly coloured.
Yeah, so peridots and tans and nice things, which people hadn't heard of, but, you know, it gave us another point of difference. And because of, I suppose, our age and who we were in the way of how we thought about life, a whole new stratum of people who were making money, who were sort of spurned by the establishment, you know, so they'd go into a shop in Bond Street and they'd go, excuse me, sir, this is, you know, we're busy or whatever it is, because they were wearing jeans and a t-shirt, yeah, or whatever, or were nervous to go into them.
Yes.
Women would go in and they'd say, you know, I'd like this, and they'd say, will the husband be back later to pay for it, sort of thing. You know, so we were handed a lot of advantage by the misogyny and the sort of old-fashioned attitudes of all those people. So our clientele was always over 50% women buying jewellery themselves.
Who were rich enough to do so, like Madonna or Liz Hurley.
Well, and before that, even before that, you know, so people who were networking and publishing and television, so not just, you know, actresses and singers, people, whatever, you know, people who, you know, working in the creative industries and doing really well. And I would say that the national average is probably 5% of jewellery being bought by women in those days, and ours was always over 50%. Yes. That's really when, you know, things changed. And then we went into... This man from Harrods turned up one day and said, do we want to be in, you know, a corner shop in Harrods? And it has to be said that, it gave us a level of, I suppose, acceptability and, you know, sort of gravitas that otherwise, you know, well, it's that funny place set down there with those weird blokes, you know, and doing stuff for rock, you know, would I... That's not really me, but somehow Harris gave it a bit of gave us a bit of sort of, you know, respectability, I suppose, whatever. And because of that, people from Mitsukoshi in Japan, because they were sort of emulating what Harris did, asked us to go into Japan, and then it got a bit kind of wild.
And at what stage did you decide to start having fun and did things like invent the silver lid for the Marmite jar and?
Well, we always did that.
You always did that, didn't you? From
the beginning? Yeah, we always did things like that. I mean, with silver, because silver had been sort of... I'd watched it and seen it. And the only real silver that wasn't old-fashioned, as it were, was rather sort of self-consciously arty. Gerald Benny or...
Yes.
Those sort of things. Yes. Yeah, they were sort of... Which all came from Scandinavia.
Yes, Danish, lots of Danish silver.
Yeah, so it was sort of people like George Jensen, yes. Those sort of people.
Yes.
Every sort of silver collection or big table would have things on it, whether it was ships, whether it was shooting, whether it was whatever it is, that reflected the interests or the background of the owner. So we really just took a tradition that's been, you know, 1,000 years in the making. And carried it on in a more sort of contemporary way.
So can we talk about you being very contemporary? Because I think I'd really like just to touch on the 2007 exhibition at the Museum of Mankind, because that's when I very first interviewed you for The Spectator. I think because you were so doing things so differently and using different beautiful stones, there was this idea that you were doing bling. You know, rather than real proper talismanic heirlooms.
Mm. Yes, I think what I wanted to do was dissociate myself from the huge new sort of influence that had taken over not just the jewellery world, but lots of worlds, which was the great branding idea. Essentially meant you were buying things because they were sort of pre-stamped as acceptable. And I think what had happened is so many people had made so much money very quickly and from, you know, very strange reasons. And they no longer had the time or the inclination to say, you know, why is this a good wine? They would just say, what's the most expensive? And somebody would say, let's say Chateau Lafite. And they'd go, I've heard of that, I'll have that.
Yes.
A lot of those people... probably had no self-confidence or really any sort of idea. And the last thing those would want is to be laughed at. So if they were going to buy a picture and they were going to spend $1 million on it, they wanted to be on the wall. And when people came in to go, I know what that is.
Yeah,
and I know it's worth $1 million or whatever it is. Yeah. and so its tentacles reached into not just, you know, the obviously branded things, but you know, into the art world, music, everything.
Yes.
And... So I realised, you know, when it first started to happen, that what the two neat things that needed guarding were craftsmanship.
Yes.
Because otherwise it would just disappear in everything. And I mean, you know, from dry stone walling to, you know, enamelling. Secondly, that people needed to be educated in a way that meant they would really have a love for the thing. They'd learn how it was made, they'd learn what it could be. They'd learn that a piece of jewellery could be theirs. I made a ring for somebody which was a magpie, two magpies, one on either side, and a birthstone at the top that opened up, because a man said, I want something unusual, we've just had a boy and we've got two daughters and whatever it is, and I don't want an eternity ring, I just want something good.
Mm-hmm.
So he made this thing with the two magpies and then with the birthstone of the sun, and then a little nest inside, a little magpie nest with four little eggs in it. So it was one for sorrow, two for joy, three for girl, four for boy. And she was wearing it one evening at a dinner party, and she just got it, and she was just whatever. And a woman around the table said, "Look what Steve gave me," whatever it was. And there was this socking great diamond, I mean, really big, bright, showy off diamond. And she was doing this. Oh, my rock. God.
Yeah.
But in their mind, they were computing how much that cost.
Yeah.
It must have been a check, to be honest. You know, or, you know, a few gold ingots. And she said, "Well, I've just got a ring as well." And as it went around the table, everybody oohed and aahed. Everybody went, "Oh, my God." Mm. And, I, you know, she explained about the, you know, four for a boy. And everybody, "Oh, my God." The reaction it got was the reaction of a really terrific play that takes everybody's breath away, rather than a huge firework display that goes on for half an hour.
Yeah.
At the end of which you go, "Oh, well, yeah, what did that cost?" Rather than whatever. And it sort of really made me think there's a different way to view jewellery. That my thesis, as it were, my internal thesis, became, well, jewellery is either, at the very bottom, purely a way of decorating yourself, which has been going on for thousands of years, and it should never, as it were, go out of its own realm, which is whatever's handy, make something lovely out of it and wear it and whatever. Costume, if you like, jewellery. At the very top is power jewellery. Could be a crown, could be a sceptre, but there's also that power jewellery of Fred gives Mary this socking great ring. This is his power. This is his, you know, I own you. This is that much, whatever it is. No thought, no emotion, really, just money. But in the middle is what I think is real jewellery, which is beautifully made. It could be made by Fabergé, it could be made by, but tiny little things they made. Little charms or whatever. They're beautifully made and they have the right kind of feeling behind it. It is, "I'm giving you this, I've had it made for you, it's yours forever." And it can be ornamented. It doesn't have to be necessarily a specific thing. It can be just purely ornamental. It can be big diamonds. It doesn't matter. But it made in a way that suits the person, that is truly beautiful, is truly crafted and whatever. Is the sort of jewellery that interests me, and I wanted to show it like that at that show, and I wanted people to look at it as they would a picture. We've got so used to seeing jewellery in an airport, you know, down a sort of causeway, in a road, the same stuff all over the world. It's become a sort of, you know, we've forgotten about little places where you just see what they're making in there.
Yes.
And there are places like Venice. You can go to little, you know, the outskirts of LA where different things are made, in India, whatever. But we're getting out of that now. People are going much, since COVID certainly, people are getting much, much more back to craftsmanship, back to where it came from, you know, what the thought process and the techniques and things that we used, and having jewellery made and whatever.
That's very encouraging. But I think what's lovely, everything you say about jewellery is in a way a metaphor for your life, because, you know, we were talking just before we started today about, you know, good life is not about having a rich life. It's about other things. It's not about money at all. And you've got a fantastically happy family life. And you're also successful. I mean, what is it like being, you know, the father of two such astonishing successful girls, one being an Oscar winner and the other being a dress designer of enormous reputation? And your wife is just about, are we allowed to say
what she's
about
to do?
She's about to have, is it say what she's about to do?
Well, she's about to start a film which at the moment is called The Bitter End, about the last days of Wallace Simpson. Starring, which it will be, Jane Collins and Isabella Rossellini.
Amazing.
So she's thrilled a bit. No, I mean, having three powerful and clever women around one is fantastic. if I don't say that, I'll be beaten up when I get home. But the I think, you know, success, I'm certainly not successful, nor I've ever been in the financial sense that I've made huge amounts of money, whatever. I never have, and I don't suppose I ever will, but it's much more that I would rather sort of immodestly call my life success, because I do have a family I absolutely adore, who are all extremely kind, and I enjoy what I do. I love being with my friends. There are a thousand things I enjoy outside jewellery and silversmithing. I mean, you know, sport and theatre and music and everything. Occasionally karaoke. and I can't say that anyone could ever be bored or not have a whole lot of interest. And I think, you know, working, which I do both here and obviously at home, and then with some of the sort of students and things, with young people, is incredibly incredibly good for one. I mean, it keeps you on your toes, and it keeps you listening to new music, hearing new things, being told about new things. And I don't think, I think the moment you stop doing that, I think you let the old person in, and then things start to atrophy, and you start to shrivel and die and become absolutely hideous.
Oldies, listen up.
Yeah, but I think a certain amount of vanity, both physical and intellectual, and in what you do and how you it is needed, because otherwise we all just let ourselves wobble into nothingness. But I think, no, what you were saying about the money thing is that I think I probably, if I'd been more sensible or less impetuous, and certainly cleverer, I'm sure I could have made a huge amount of money. But I think with that would have come all sorts of things. I mean, I don't think the family unit would have been as cohesive. I don't know. I doubt it. I think I'd have lost a lot of friends and probably gained a lot of people around me, type of thing. I think, you know, that with great wealth should go an enormous amount of obligation, an enormous amount of work that is perhaps not selfish. And I think, you know, it's a rare person who can both make lots of money and handle it well. And I think, you know, there are limits to really what anybody should have in the way of power or influence or probably money.
You are one of the happiest people I know, or appear to be, and you do laugh a lot. And I think coming back to where we started with your book, you know, your book is just, it's such a lesson in how to look at life, really. I mean, just don't take it too seriously and mob yourself up.
Yeah, I mean, it's a terrific defence mechanism, I have to say. It became so ingrained to not take things seriously. And even when it was no longer just irresponsibility and sort of a certain amount of solipsism, obviously it was a certain amount of selfishness that you need to be that, you know, that irresponsible. But even when that toned down into a little bit more sort of pragmatism, although not much more, I found this thing of nothing is that serious. Life and death is serious. Extreme poverty is serious. Terror is serious. Not knowing if the knock on your door is life or death, which I don't know what percentage of the world lives in, but it's a huge population.
Too many, yeah.
That you should take seriously. That you haven't got food to eat, that you're terribly ill. But right the way along the line, those of us who've been, you know, born at the time I was born and lived the sort of life we've been allowed to live, have absolutely nothing to whinge about. I think, you know, it's much more joyous if you find things funny. And I think what it does mean, though, that all sorts of things that can, as it were, corrupt your feeling good,
yeah,
that can embarrass you, shame you, feel you let yourself down or feel you haven't achieved or whatever it is, if you see all those things as potential humorous anecdotes or whatever, it takes nearly all the angst out of it. And that just leaves you with the serious things, like, you know, matters of life or death, or, you know, unhappy children, or whatever it is that really does cause genuine worry and angst. You know, if you're not in a poverty trap, and that not of your making, then you really should be able to withstand anything, you know, just by having a laugh.
Well, what a great note to end on.
Yes, B-flat minor.
No, and how great that you've made so many great anecdotes out of your life that we're all able to read. The book is extremely funny. It I'm still laughing. Thank you, Theo Fennell, so much.
Not at all, thank you.
You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, talking to Theo Fennell. If you've enjoyed our conversation and would like to hear more like this, please go to www.theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. My very warm thanks again to Theo Fennell, to Bailey Gifford for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye. You've been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.